Sort of mild particle creation, where
By mild, I'm going to mean that we're going to create particles, but we're still going to have a well-defined notion, roughly approximately well-defined notion of particles, even though we're in a time-dependent space-time. And so this is essentially, we're going to call this sort of quasi-adiabatic adiabatic regime. I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. And essentially, we're going to deal with situations where there is a well-defined S matrix for particle creation. So you're presumably familiar with the idea of an S matrix from quantum field theory. You take some state defined at minus infinity, t is minus infinity, an incoming state, usually called an in state, which I'll label by in. And that's the state you send into the system. It may be vacuum, it may be filled with some particles, whatever it is. So if you're calculating some kind of scattering process like that, your in state is a state with two particles. And then you want to compute at essentially plus infinity, so in the far future of the interactions, what the state looks like. Well, not what the state looks like, really, but what the amplitude, the probability amplitude, to see a given state at t is plus infinity is. So you want to compare with t is plus infinity, in other words, compare with a given out state. But in the meantime, there's been some physics that went on, some interactions, and so you have to take this state, which was defined at minus infinity. So here I'm working in the Heisenberg representation, but conceptually it's easier now to switch to the Schrodinger representation, where what we do is we think we take the in state and we evolve it from minus infinity to plus infinity with the Hamiltonian. So this is what the in state looks like at minus infinity. And then this time-ordered product evolves it from minus infinity up to plus infinity. And then you sandwich it with the out state. And that thing there is the probability amplitude that given the in state as your initial condition, that you find yourself to be in the out state. Okay, so that's just the standard familiar notion of S matrix. So when is an S matrix well defined on a curved space-time? Well, essentially when we have well defined asymptotic states. So we need a notion, well defined asymptotic states. So by asymptotic, we mean that both t is minus infinity and both t is plus infinity. In other words, we need to have a well defined notion of in and out states. And specifically, that means there needs to be a well-defined notion of the vacuum at t is plus or minus infinity. And then if we have a well-defined notion of vacuum, we can act creation annihilation operators on that and create many particle states, and then ask the question, we have two particles coming in a particular configuration, what's the probability amplitude for two particles to come out in a given configuration? So this is in an arbitrary curved space-time, there may not exist a well-defined S matrix. This is an important point. So S matrix is a concept you learn in Minkowski space, but in a curved space, an arbitrary curved space, there may not be a well-defined S matrix because this condition may not be true. And an example of a space-time for which that's not true is De Sitter space, in fact. In De Sitter space, there is no well-defined S matrix, because although you can define particles, you can define a vacuum at T as minus infinity, you can't define the vacuum at T as plus infinity. So what we mean by a well-defined notion of a vacuum in practice, so what we mean by this well-defined vacuum is essentially going to be something called the adiabatic vacuum. And so just to remind you of the equation, so yesterday we showed that if you had a massive scalar on FRW, so its starting action was this form, then by doing some working in conformal time, and conformal time is always the best to do problems like this, so where the metric looks like that, and redefining phi is 1 over A times U. Did I call it U? I think so. Something like that. Then plugging that into the action, you show that the action is equivalent to a massless scalar, U looking like a massless scalar on Minkowski space, where this thing is now the kinetic term on the conformally related Minkowski spacetime, plus an effective mass term, which is a function of time, where this thing, sorry, for U squared, where M squared effective was M squared A squared minus A double prime over A. So, in fact, so the equations of motion for that then are just U prime prime, where prime denotes a d by d conformal time, minus del squared U, and then that's going to be equal to minus M squared effective is a function of eta U. And because we're dealing on an FRW spacetime that nevertheless still is, although it's time dependent, it's still translation invariant, we can still decompose modes into Fourier modes. So let's do something like that. And just and then the equation for each Fourier mode looks like, so you have a k squared U, k is minus m squared effective eta uk, and then we usually, so that's prime prime, and then we usually rewrite that U prime prime k of t is minus omega squared k, sorry, but beg your pardon, I meant eta, k omega squared of eta uk of eta, where this frequency is just the effective mass squared plus k squared. A familiar looking formula if you were doing things on flat space, but now everything here is a function of conformal time. So in most problems you're going to deal with, the hardest thing you're going to have to solve is this guy, this equation here. And that doesn't look too complicated. Unfortunately, in practice, it is pretty complicated because for an arbitrary time dependence here, it's quite difficult to get explicit solutions of that equation. But we're going to deal with a few approximation methods that will be able to give us some answers. And then on top of that, there's a few known analytic solutions. And otherwise, you can just do it numerically, of course. Any questions on that? So we need some kind of approximation to say something about that equation. And there is one regime which there is a nice systematic approximation. And this is the so-called adiabatic regime. And hence the adiabatic vacuum, as we're going to see. Adiabatic is a term that's complete. Yeah. Yes.
When you go compute that effective mass, is it true you have to do an integration by parts to?
That's correct. Yes.
So, do you have to assume something about V, like it falls off infinity?
That's a very good question. So when you do integration by parts in space, you do have to worry about boundary terms. Because the boundary conditions change the physics, and so if you have a finite boundary doing an integration by parts in space, you pick up a term on the boundary. Even in a space that's asymptotically flat, you've got to be very careful because things don't fall off that rapidly. For time integrations, it's true that you pick up a boundary term from, but what it does is it corresponds to just doing unitary transformation on your original state and on your final state. And so it's like you're doing, you know, when you go from Heisenberg representation. No, it's not. That would be nice. It's not that simple. No, it's rather you pick up a. So let's suppose you have something that's like T, a dot. You pick up. This looks like a at t is infinity. Minus a at t is minus infinity. But if you think of that sandwiched between, if you'd been calculating the S matrix. HDT in, then because this product is time ordered, then and this thing is basically action, then this what you would have is that because it's time ordered, the T is minus infinity part would just multiply over here and change your in state, and your T is plus infinity part would just multiply over here and change your out state. And this is now the H without the A piece. So it does have an effect, but it just sort of transforms your original state, and it meant that you were really dealing with a different state. However, when we define an S matrix, we make this implicit assumption that all interactions fall off at plus infinity and minus infinity. So if you add that assumption, this thing is actually supposed to be zero, and therefore it won't make any difference. If you're not dealing with an S matrix, you're actually dealing with a finite time correlator, then it makes a difference. But again, it's really just a change in your what you called an in state. So I can always do this I can always throw away that piece, bearing in mind that it's just correspond to changing my in-state general representation. It's a bit like going from Schrodinger representation to Heisenberg representation. It's a change of basis. It's a good question, though. So in the adiabatic regime, adiabatic is a word that's heavily overused in physics, and it often means very different things, but in the present context, it simply means slowly varying. And the condition that we'll see for the slowly variation is if the frequency is a function of time. So the intuition is we know if this was independent of time, we'd know how to solve that in terms of positive and negative frequency modes. It would be clear how to do. Now, in general, when this depends on time, you can't do that anymore. But if it's only slowly varying in time, then roughly at each time step, you think you're in a space with a constant frequency, and so you have roughly speaking a well-defined notion of positive frequency modes at a given time, but as time changes, the frequency changes. So the condition for the adiabatic regime to be true is that the change omega prime, so by that we mean d omega d eta, the change in the frequency is small in some sense, and the thing that it has to be small relative to is omega squared. So to see how to derive that regime, it's useful to put some h-bars back in. We've been setting h-bar as 1 all the way along, but let's rewrite that equation. If we put h-bar back inside, the equation would look like that, just like in the Schrödinger equation. You're supposed to have a h-bar squared here in front of double derivatives. And this thing, h-bar omega, is some notion of energy. So we can define an energy, Ek of eta, is h-bar omega k. So in the classical limit, it's E that's finite. So the classical h-bar goes to 0 limit, E is finite. H-bar goes to 0, omega becomes large. So let's rewrite this equation in this form, Ek squared Uk, and take an ansatz for the equation that has the following structure, E to the I W over H bar times A times something that goes of order 1 plus H bar B. So this is what we're essentially going to do. It's a WKB approximation, which is essentially, in the present context, a loop expansion. So we're going to expand in powers of H bar. So H bar controls the strength of interaction. H-bar controls the strength of the quantum aspects of the problem. We know as h-bar goes to 0, everything should become classical. And h-bar itself measures the quantum corrections to the classical evolution. So that's precisely what we're going to do here. The leading term as h-bar goes to 0, this exponent becomes very large, and so this is the dominant piece. And so this is what we call the zero loop or the tree level contribution. When you do Feynman diagram scattering, that's the tree level. This piece, if you think of it in the exponent as log a, this is down by 1 power of h bar relative to this guy, and so this is the one loop. So when you do Feynman diagrams, that's something that it looks like this. And this thing here is two loop and higher, and I'm imagining this is a series. So what we're doing is a loop expansion. You might wonder what this is a loop expansion of precisely. It's actually the loop expansion of the path integral for a first quantized particle in a curved spacetime. But we're not going to do it that way because that's too complicated for now. But that's the origin of this expansion. But you could just call it the WKB expansion and not think about what its real physical origin is. And so all we're going to do is take this ansatz. So I'm going to assume that this is small, the two loop and higher loops are small. Take that ansatz and plug into the equation. So U is E to the I W over H bar A. U prime is going to be I W prime over H bar, E to the I W over H bar, plus E to the I, A prime. U prime prime is going to be I W prime prime over H bar. Just shout out if you see I've missed something, because it's hard to do things on the board. Plus 2i omega prime over h. Sorry, I missed an a there. 2i omega prime h a prime plus e to the i W. This is W, not omega. Sorry, A prime prime. Does that look right? Have I missed something? I missed an A on the first term. Now I've got the W prime prime, the W prime, A prime, A double prime. Ah, yeah, there is one piece I missed, which is if I differentiated that, brought it down again, I would pick up a minus W prime squared over H bar squared. That looks right. Bear in mind, I just make a comment about that for those of you that have done the string theory things. This, because this is the H bar is counting loops in a first quantized system, it's the same H bar that counts the genus. Is the genus expansion in when you do string scattering amplitudes. The same loop there. But anyway, doesn't matter. So that's U double prime. And we're multiplying that by H bar squared. H bar squared. And then this piece goes away. And actually, you see now why we normalize things in this way. We normalize it as W over H bar because we knew when we were going to differentiate, we were going to multiply by H bar squared. And so there's a piece here which comes without any H bar suppression. So remember, H bar is small. So this is small, this is small, this is small. This thing is the dominant piece. And this thing is supposed to be equal to minus H bar squared. Sorry, minus E squared of K times U. So the right-hand side also has no H-bar suppression, because what we've done is we've said that really the physical thing is H-bar omega, not omega. That's the energy, and that's the thing in the classical limit that should be kept constant, not the frequency. Yep.
Maybe you said what's the meaning of E in this context?
What's the meaning of E? Oh, it's the physical energy. I mean, in some sense, there is going to be a notion of particle here, and it's the energy of the particle. Yeah. And then energy is H bar omega. Let me just check I got all the terms before. One of them I didn't normalize right. That's H bar squared. So then the essence, what we were doing is an expansion in powers of H bar. So we read this equation by comparing terms of a given order in H bar. So you'll notice, of course, these exponentials, they just drop out. They factor out on each side. So you compare what's on the left-hand side. So the leading term is this piece. That's got no H-bar suppression. And on the right-hand side, the leading term is that piece. And so you just derive that W prime squared has to be E squared K of eta. In other words, WK is plus or minus, WK prime is plus or minus EK eta. So WK is plus or minus the integral of H bar omega K of eta d eta up to some time. And I'm going to be careless and not put this as a dummy variable. It should be obvious what I mean by that. The WK at some time eta is given by that. Then you compare the subleading piece, So that's got no h-bar suppressions. These two terms here, they have h-bar suppressions. On the right-hand side, we have nothing with a h-bar suppression. So these two terms better just cancel against each other directly. So we must have that I W prime prime H bar A is equal to minus 2 I W prime H bar A prime. In other words, W prime prime over 2 W prime is equal to minus A prime over A. W prime itself was EK plus or minus EK. So W prime prime is EK prime plus or minus EK prime. The sign's not going to matter because it's going to cancel. So this is the same as EK prime prime over 2 EK, sorry, EK prime over EK, which is the same as omega K. Omega k prime over 2 omega k, which is minus a prime over a. And it's not too hard to spot that the solution for the a is some constant over square root of omega, and for reasons of normalization, I'm going to put a root 2 in there. Can everyone see this from that? Is it obvious? Essentially, because this is minus log A prime, and that's a half log omega K prime. So that's the solution for A. So we've got the leading order piece, W, we've got A. And then we go down to H bar squared. But at this point, we can't trust this equation anymore because there were other terms of order H bar here that would come in and cancel those off. And so the approximation, this is an approximation method we're doing, the approximation we make is to assume that this thing is negligible. So we'll just ignore it. And that's the WKB approximation, or the adiabatic approximation, or the loop expansion. It's got lots of names. It's got the other one, but there's some other name I can't think of. Lots of different names for the same thing. Okay, so in other words, we're saying that the modes, the solutions, look like approximately some constant over root 2 omega k eta, and then they can have two signs, which of course are our positive and negative frequency modes, so let me write the signs that way around, times I integral omega k to eta. So this defines some well-defined notion of positive and negative frequency modes. What? Oh, sorry, hadn't you... sorry. you can see it there. You can imagine it. Exactly. So there is a condition at some point. Lost my train of thought. Oh, okay. Yeah. So the condition that this approximation is a valid one is essentially that this thing, that this quantity here, is a slowly varying function relative to this quantity here. So it's exactly what we said. That so it's turned out that the coefficient in front is the frequency, and so precisely the adiabatic approximation is that the frequency is slowly varying with respect to this thing. This is oscillating wildly. Even if the frequency is a constant, this thing is oscillating. For this approximation to be a good one, we have to assume that this quantity is a slowly varying function relative to this guy. Border of it. Over there. So in other words, so the measure of the rate of change of the exponent is W prime over W, fractional change of W. Our assumption is that this varies much more rapidly than the rate of change of the loop part. So that the tree part captures most of the time dependence. This is the tree part captured by W, whereas the loop part, the one loop part, is subdominant. And that's crucial so that you don't then, when you calculate the higher order corrections, you don't then, those are truly suppressed. So essentially there's a sort of consistent expansion. And this thing, when you plug in what we now know for W and A, this is precisely the condition that omega over omega squared is much less than unity, effectively. So actually I mean W prime. So that's the condition for the adiabatic approximation to be true. So this is really the condition to have a well-defined vacuum. Because here we see something that really clearly splits into positive and negative frequency modes, and so I know how to quantize this. I know really how to pick the vacuum. I just do exactly what I did in flat space. Now we're quantizing the mode ut of x, although just to remind you, phi t of x was u times a. Did I get that's the right way around, yeah. So when we're quantizing phi, we're quantizing u. It doesn't matter which variable you choose. So it's invariant under field redefinitions. So this quantity now, when we quantize it, what we're doing is we split into creation and annihilation operators. And the annihilation operator is multiplied by the negative frequency mode. And the creation operator is multiplied by the positive frequency mode. And so the vacuum defined by AK0 is 0 is what we call the adiabatic vacuum. So we've now done something pretty good, actually, because before we thought we had to have some... Yeah.
So where's the x dependence?
Sorry, I keep dropping it. it's exactly where it should be. Right. Just assume from now on I always drop the x dependence by default. Was that right? Okay.
Well, that's what you said.
I must have been right then. Phi is u over a. That's right. I'm sorry. So we've done something good because before we to have a notion of positive and negative frequencies, we needed a notion of energy. To have a notion of energy, we needed a time-like Killing vector, and in general, time-dependent space does not have a time-like Killing vector. For obvious reasons. But now we've done a little better. Even in a space which is time dependent, we can define something like a positive and negative frequency mode. And the trick, of course, what we've done is we've assumed the space varies, it varies in time, but not too fast. So it varies in time sufficiently slowly that at a given time we can still define something like positive and negative frequency modes as if we were in Minkowski space. And so that's essentially the adiabatic regime. Now, if the adiabatic condition was always valid, you would never get any particle creation, because these would just be the solutions for all time. That would be it. So they're true. These solutions are true at minus infinity. These solutions are true at plus infinity. And so the adiabatic vacuum maps to the adiabatic vacuum. So any situation of real interest is where what we have is at t is minus infinity, or t is minus infinity, we have the adiabatic vacuum. Adiabatic vacuum is good. So over here, omega prime over omega squared is much less than 1. So this is time going this way. And then we go along for a bit. And then at some point, this condition breaks down. So omega prime over omega squared, say, hits 1 or even becomes bigger. And then that's called a non-adiabatic regime, for obvious reasons. Now, if that was true all the way to plus infinity, we would be screwed, because we'd have no well-defined way to define particles at plus infinity. So the situations in which we can talk about an S matrix, as I said, an S matrix is well-defined when you have a well-defined vacuum at minus infinity, which now we've precisely said what we really mean by that is the adiabatic vacuum, and an adiabatic vacuum at plus infinity. Over here, T is plus infinity. And this is actually, roughly speaking, what happens in inflation. Because during inflation itself, it's a de Sitter phase. And in a de Sitter phase, as you go back in time in a de Sitter phase, this condition becomes better and better. So de Sitter space has a well-defined vacuum at minus infinity. But then when inflation ends, you go from an accelerating phase to a decelerating phase, and it switches round. In a decelerating phase, you have a well-defined vacuum at plus infinity. And then in the intermediate, the sort of reheating phase, everything goes a little bit crazy. So this roughly fits with here is inflation. Inflation ends, you reheat, things go a bit crazy, but then you have subsequent decelerated expansion set by matter and radiation and then matter. Unfortunately, then that gets screwed, because then dark energy comes in and dominates at late times, and you go back to a situation where you don't have a well-defined notion of vacuum anymore, but we don't need to worry about that for purposes of calculating particle creation from cosmology, but people do worry about it. People worry about it. There isn't a well-defined notion of an S matrix in de Sitter space. This is connected with why it was very difficult to get de Sitter space out of string theory for many years, because there isn't a well-defined S matrix, and so the whole perturbative framework of string theory is based on an S matrix. So no, precisely because we know we're accelerating now. So that forces you to say, well, how do you make sense of physics when you don't have a well-defined S matrix? And the level of field theory, it's fine. But in string theory, there's no framework. You know, you need something like string field theory, and it's nobody knows how to do that. Okay, so it's the non adiabatic stuff that gives you particle creation. So let me define a given mode UK. Let me define UK plus eta in this general setting, where we will have adiabatic but non-adiabatic and adiabatic evolution, by definition, we've said that as t goes to minus infinity, which may or may not be eta goes to minus infinity, because sometimes when you conformally map from conformal time to proper time is minus infinity, can sometimes end up being finite conformal time, but so just be wary of that. But roughly speaking, as t goes to minus infinity, you have a mode that we've normalized in the flat space sense that looks like that. There's then an intermediate non-adiabatic regime, and then the same mode, when you look at it, the same mode just evolving its equations, be it analytically or numerically, as t goes to plus infinity. This mode will come out, the adiabatic vacuum will be true again, so we can still use positive and negative frequency modes. But the key difference is it won't necessarily just be a positive frequency mode. In general, it'll be some superposition of the two. And as we said yesterday, another way of interpreting this is what you've done is change your vacuum state, because then if you look at the form of UTX now as t goes to plus infinity, so now it's going to be of the form 1 over root 2 omega k, and then it's alpha k e to the minus I plus beta k e to the plus I plus a k dagger 1 over root 2 omega k, and then alpha k star e to the plus I plus beta k star e to the minus I. But we could rewrite this as bk over root 2 omega k e to the minus I plus bk dagger over root 2 omega k e to the plus I. Yeah?
Are all these omegas everywhere the same?
So this is the omega at plus infinity there, and here it was the omega at minus. So this is a function of time.
Okay. So.
Yeah, so this is omega at plus infinity. Yeah. These are not, so I'm not going to write that because it's implicit in the adiabatic approximation that this is a function of time. So, yeah, but be wary of that. So we normalize with respect to the frequency at that time. So this looks like that, where now bk is alpha k ak plus bk star ak dagger, which is precisely the definition of the Golubov transform. And so particle creation is equivalent to actively sort of doing a Golubov transform on the creation and annihilation operators. And so the out vacuum. So remember, to define an S matrix, we had to have an in vacuum and an out vacuum. The out vacuum is not the same as the in vacuum. So the in vacuum was defined as the state which was annihilated by the AKs, but the out vacuum is the state that's annihilated by the BKs. Because if you were an observer at late times and you didn't know anything about what was going on before you, you would have split your modes into positive and negative frequency modes like this. That would be, so to an observer at plus infinity, that would be how he would split his fields up, and he would say, well, my natural vacuum is the one that's annihilated by these operators. But the observer at minus infinity uses these operators. So crucially, even without any interactions, the in vacuum is not equal to the out vacuum as long as beta is non-zero. And remember that in this formula, we had to have alpha k squared minus beta k squared is equal to unity.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Is the I and minus I in those exponents, is that just shorthand that you're not writing in the data book?
Yeah.
Okay.
It gets tiresome to keep writing it out. And crucially, the most important physical thing is that an observer, so let me call him B observer. So B observer is the guy who uses the B creation annihilation operators, which are the ones with a well-defined plus infinity. In other words, who uses the out vacuum. So he will define his number of particles. He will count, as we said before, using this operator. That's how he counts the eigenvalues of that operator. Are numbers. The expectation value of that operator is the best thing you can say to the number of particles that you have in your state. And the point is that if you're actually in the in vacuum, which is what you are actually in, you send the in vacuum in. But a guy who's in the B vacuum counts in that state. What does that state look like? How many particles do I see in the state which is really the in vacuum? This essentially determines the number of particles created. So it's the number of particles seen by an observer at plus infinity, assuming the state that was sent in was the state in which there were no particles at minus infinity. So that's why this is really literally the number of particles created. And so this thing is just that. And then given the definition of BK, BK in, so because the A's annihilate the in state, this thing is just beta star K AK in, because the other piece just goes to zero. And similarly, in BK dagger is in AK beta k, just by taking the complex conjugate of that. Pardon?
Good.
Looks okay?
Yeah.
I've suddenly confused myself. What the hell have I done?
What's wrong? Did you just sandwich those?
So I want to say this answer is integral to 3k over 2 pi cubed mod beta k squared. Does that look okay? Yeah. Okay. Sorry, I'm just being tired today. So anyway, so that's the answer. Number of particles. Great. So on a daily basis you don't need to recalculate that every time. You just need to remember that this is the answer for the total number of particles created, or the number density is mod beta k squared. The energy, by the way, the energy you create, it's also easy to calculate. Because at plus infinity, again, in the adiabatic regime, you have a well-defined notion of energy for each particle is essentially the frequency there. So the effective energy you see is integral d3k. So you have nk particles, and each one has an energy h bar omega k at plus infinity. So that's mod beta k squared. And I'll set h bar back to 1. So that's the total energy seen by an observer at plus infinity, the energy of particles you create. That's right. Yeah, exactly. Because that's right. Yeah, but this is the right way around to say it. Because what you the actual state is the end state, right? So that's the actual state of the system, and then you've got to say, well, how am I going to count particles in that state? And this guy uses this operator, and his number of particles is the expectation value of that operator in the actual state of the system, which is the end state. There is something weird. Yeah, that's what I was confusing myself over. But I think there's a normalization to do with. There's a volume factor. So that infinite integral is the volume, and then it's the number density.
Okay.
So it's one of those things where you get an infinite. It's like when you do calculate the S matrix, it's technically infinite, but what you actually calculate is a scattering rate per unit volume, and you divide by the volume. Yeah,
so that's the energy density then?
That's the actual. That's the energy density. That's right. It's really per unit volume. That's right. It's the number density. Yeah, there was an infinite integral that gave you the volume. I'll sort that out by Monday because I've just confused myself. It's true, but yeah. yeah, of course. It's the total number of particles is always infinite because the space is infinite. It's the density that's finite. So that's the number density. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, the commutator is the volume.
These are like steps that, you know, you forget. Okay, so in the last. So the last few minutes, I'll show you sort of. So that was one approximation scheme, but we haven't yet sort of figured out a way of actually calculating the betas in any good scheme. We have a way of defining the vacuum at minus infinity, the vacuum at plus infinity. Well, actually, maybe I'm going to go over. So maybe I'll do this on Monday. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to cut short today because. So that we don't go too over. So are there any other questions? So let me do it properly. So the point is that when you take the expectation value, you get what you actually had then was in AK dagger in when you commute them. You naively get a delta function 2 pi cubed delta 3, 0, times in, which is 1. And so this thing looks like 2 pi cubed delta 3 of 0, which is infinite. But this is where we always do the trick when we do field theory of what we really mean by 2 pi cubed delta 3, 0. Is is 1 over V. Okay? Is
because it's the delta function of K is 0.
Is V. That's right. Yeah. It's the thing that's infinite. That's right. So it's the volume of space. And so the point is that, you know, it just comes from the fact that the right thing to quantize is the phase space. This is sort of the thing that gets quantized in quantum mechanics. And so if you have a space of volume V, then the sort of quantized integrals go like that. And so in some sense, the delta function is the inverse of this thing, saying that it's the volume. And the way you, if you really want to do that rigorously, what you do is actually take your space R3 and put it on a torus so that your coordinates, this is all like standard stuff, right? I'm probably people seen before. You take your coordinates to run from plus L to minus L for each of your coordinates, so that the volume of the space is actually 2L cubed. And then what you mean by the delta function is really, so delta K is integral d3x e to the I k dot x. That was the real, so I guess it's minus, that was the real definition of the delta function. Actually 2 pi cubed times that. That's the definition of the delta function in K space by doing it from X space. And then now you see most explicitly that what you've done is you've compactified the volume. So this is 2 pi cubed delta 3, 0 is integral to 3x, which is good. Yep.
Just quickly on. So what have we shown here? Have we demonstrated that there's a constant bath of particles in the space, or what's the physical interpretation of?
Yeah, it's literally there's a bath of particles. So it's some density, which is finite, and you'll see that everywhere.
Uniform.
Yeah. So it doesn't have to be uniform. Here it's automatically uniform because the space was isotropic and homogeneous. So any particles you create have to have a homogeneous and isotropic distribution. But in a more complicated space where the space itself is anisotropic, then you can create more particles over here and more particles over there. So this is the number per unit volume. That's the finite thing per unit K. So the total number per unit volume is the integral of this d3. The total number is then the integral over the volume as well. But you never want to calculate that. You always want this piece in practice.
So
just by solving the equation. That's the hard bit. Unfortunately, there aren't many nice, exactly solvable. That's why I was saying before, there aren't many nice, exactly solvable things. But you did one yesterday in the problem, so and there'll be another one in the homework. Or maybe you didn't do it, but you can do it again. Yeah.